the conditions for his staying would happen, which goes to his unrealistic expectation about everything, and I did not dissuade him. He knew we were talking to ABC, and I never told him it was a no-shot, just a long-shot. He kind of settled in, although we kept having terrible results in our live-action business, and he became more secretive. If Jeffrey was on his way to Washington, I wouldn't even know. I would say to my secretary, "I need to talk to Jeff." She would find him on the plane. I would say, "Where are you?" He would answer, "On the plane." "Oh," I would respond, "Where are you going?" He would simply say, "Washington." He would never give either Frank or me more information. We would have to dig and dig. Mostly we gave up. As his letter suggests, Eisner was troubled by Disney's continuing dismal performance in live-action films. Under Katzenberg's direction, the studio was having a great year thanks to video sales of Beauty and the Beast and the continuing success at the box office of Aladdin. But the bonanza from animation masked the continued weak performance of live action now that Disney was running both Touchstone and Hollywood studios and churning out 40 films a year. There were a few modest successes. What's Love Got to Do with It?, a biography of Tina Turner. The Joy Luck Club, a remake of Tombstone with Val Kilmer and Kurt Russell, and a Walt Disney production, Homeward Bound, a low-budget remake of The Incredible Journey. But the only memorable work was The Nightmare Before Christmas, produced by former Disney animator Tim Burton. But given the studio's track record in live action, Eisner was increasingly derisive of Katzenberg's manifesto of 2 years earlier. Unfortunately for Katzenberg, almost every film that he'd singled out for praise, Scenes from a Mall, Billy Bathgate, and especially The Rocketeer, had been huge box office flops. Eisner attributed much of the live-action failures to his exclusion from meetings and screenings, and his belief, as he later put it, that most successful movie studios and television networks have had at least two strong executives at the top, supporting and counterbalancing one another. Eisner complained about the Katzenberg Manifesto to Tony Schwartz, characterizing it as insubordination, showing that it was still on his mind 2 years later. Schwartz's notes read, "Wrote the memo he didn't write anyway because he was so proud of it. He wanted me to read it, thought it was so brilliant. So I read it and say, 'Jeffrey, this is dynamite, putting down a lot of actors. It is also self-serving. Don't show it to anyone.' I wrote on the memo, 'Do not Xerox or send this to anyone.' He completely disobeyed me. Frank and I discussed throwing him out. From that moment on, I knew it was over. It wasn't the memo. Fact, I told him not to show it, and faxed it, and lied about it. I just let him have it. Just sits there and stares at you and walked out. Everyone I knew was pissed off. From that memo on, never made a decent movie." At their weekly dinners, Eisner expressed at least some of these concerns to Katzenberg, but he felt that Katzenberg didn't take them seriously. Katzenberg was baffled. From his vantage, Eisner had approved every movie the studio produced. He had always stressed that Eisner had the right to veto any project he didn't believe in, and he had carried out Eisner's directives even when he disagreed. A case in point was the movie Cabin Boy, starring Chris Elliott, a comedian who was performing skits on Late Show with David Letterman.